Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, the big question in the first segment is, What in the world's on your mind?
Well, a couple of things. So I had my first dinner party at the farm on Sunday, which was fun. So now the kitchen is renovated and I can actually work in it. So that was quite exciting. And what was extremely exciting was that my guests brought wine. And so we all contributed, and one of my guests had some old wine, and that was super cool. So I want to ask you about them. What were you going to say?
I thought you were going to recap your dinner party.
I am.
All the things that you made so that
I am.
All the people that you didn't invite would be annoyed with you.
Okay, so it's funny because, you know, I work very, very seasonally.
You're not even going to honor that with a response, are you?
I work very, very seasonally. And so when I went to the grocery, I'm like, oh, gosh, I'm really hungry for some strawberries. And those tomatoes in my pantry have been in there for a week. I know you're cringing, and I know that's not the way I normally cook, but for some reason we're all just so ready for summer.
Everybody has those moments
that's
in April.
That's what it is. It's like, oh, could we please just get the season changed? So I made... I was cooking fennel and Brussels sprouts last night.
Sorry.
Right. They had some gorgeous zucchini. I mean, just super, super pretty fresh zucchini. So I did zucchini carpaccio with good extra virgin olive oil, lightly chopped cilantro, and I had made a little tomato bruschetta, tomato relish for the bruschetta. And then I thought, I don't need to be doing that. So I actually ended up serving it with a little, paper-thin slices of zucchini. Right before we ate it, I sliced it. And then a little salt, kosher salt, freshly ground black pepper, the cilantro, and I put a little bit of goat cheese on. And then just because that tomato relish was looking so good, which was just tomato with good extra virgin olive oil, again, salt and pepper, and a little bit of cilantro, I just put that on top. Honestly, it was just a wonderful way to start. And we had Peter Michaels Bellecote from 2012. Oh my gosh, what a beautiful wine. It was just
giant,
delicious.
Giant rich Chardonnay.
Man, it was good. You know, and the guests didn't know what I was cooking, so it wasn't like, oh, let's pair the wine with your food. It's just,
it's not what you would have with it necessarily.
I understand that, but it was still just wonderful to taste. And I think, you know, we're so into pairing and everything has to, you know, how important it is to pair the proper food with the proper wine. But I have to say, man, it sure was great to taste that wine. And I had a bottle of Gosset.
Well, pairing is a little bit like music and dancing. You can love the music and you can love dancing to a particular piece of music, and as long as it's not like country line dancing and Mozart, everyone doesn't look super stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, it doesn't mean that you don't love the Mozart and you don't,
you
or you don't
it,
love
right.
the country
I
line
mean,
dancing.
Right. And
you know, if you're good at it, you're good at it. And Peter Michael is great, but it's
not appropriate.
Probably
for
strange,
that course,
not a context for that course. But
I get it.
That's not the point.
I'll tell you what was appropriate things. Was drinking the Gosset Celebrie 1998. Celebrie, is that
Celebrie?
Yeah.
That 98 is
98?
In good shape now.
Oh my God, vintage, extra brut, man. That was really appropriate because we were walking around the farm and it was a gorgeous day on Sunday.
So you paired that with sunshine.
Yeah, I did, and the outdoors. And man, I wish there'd have been a few chairs out there. They'll get out there eventually. But oh my gosh, that was beautiful. What do you? So you think that's a great bottle of champagne?
The 98s, the great 98s that are still around or available, mm-hmm. or that people cellared, mm-hmm. are showing well right now.
Yeah, it was exciting. And it was really, it's always interesting to me because I do drink a lot of champagne, and, you know, it's rarely vintage champagne that I drink. And why are you smiling?
Because you just said, I drink a lot of champagne.
That's
great.
But I rarely drink. So sometimes I drink champagne. I should say it that way.
What is the commercial? When I do drink, I only drink champagne.
Well, that would be my commercial. But it was cool to have the older champagne. And, you know, it's just the freshness, you know, the difference in the level, you know, how it's not fresh, basically, to me. That's what I think. I mean,
more,
I think
more
of champagne
secondary
as being,
aromas.
Yeah, it's
more
interesting.
More biscuity, more
That's a great
nutty.
Word. Okay, yeah.
Biscuit like this. This is such a pompous word to use, but it really applies. If you ever have those English tea biscuits that are literally like mm-hmm. sort of like not terribly sweet cookies
mm-hmm.
that are almost powdery, that sort of character that they can have.
Mm-hmm. And my next course was duck. I figured people would bring red wines. And I sort of did a
duck
mush
that you captured wandering around the farm.
I don't have any ducks. But I saw my maitake mushrooms and white beech at the grocery, and I haven't cooked with those in a while. I used to cook with both of them quite a bit. And it was just kind of fun to see my old friends, those two mushrooms, and both of them were in beautiful shape. And I like the white beech. I think they're just, they're, first of all, they're cute as heck, as well as they taste inherently nutty. I mean, you know, when you, and they cook pretty quickly for a mushroom. And so do the maitakes. Neither one of those mushrooms have a high water content. So they really cook pretty fast, which is nice. I mean, I can spend, you know, to really do button mushrooms and oyster mushrooms, it's probably a good 12 minutes, to maybe even 15 minutes to really cook them thoroughly. So with the beech and maitake mushrooms and cooking and, you know, cook so quickly in 3, 4, or 5 minutes, I cooked them not on pickup. As I was preparing the food for my guests, I cooked the mushrooms to order.
Picking up mushrooms, chef. How long,
the
please?
The magre I had rendered. So I scored the fat, seasoned it, let it sit in the refrigerator with salt and pepper, and rendered it. So all I had to do was sear it and finish the cooking process.
So the magre, so what do you say, duck? It was just the breast from the magre duck, right?
Yes. And so what I ended up doing was slicing it really, really thin. I mean, as thin as possible. I laid it out in the bottom of a small bowl. So it was really probably 6 or 7. I only used one breast for 5 people, which is almost nothing. And I was going to serve it as an hors d'oeuvre. You know, it's, for me, it was just, I was having fun. You know, I was cooking for
you're
fun,
drinking, you're drinking,
which doesn't happen for
go
me.
Go say celebrate champagne.
I just you're wanted to cook fun. In my new kitchen, you know. I wasn't worried about, wow, what am I going to do? It was sort of, you know, just enjoying cooking, which, as I said, is something I don't get to do very often, just to enjoy it for the heck of it. And so it sort of was an evolution. And when I decided that I didn't want to do the duck as the hors d'oeuvre, and that was because of what my guests were doing. It wasn't appropriate to do it. You know, they were kind of ready to sit down, and I had antipasto ready, and we ended up eating that. Ironically, the antipasto went out after I served the zucchini salad. While I was cooking, they were eating the antipasto, which worked out really, really well for me because I'm doing everything, you know, by myself, and so they're entertaining themselves and having a good time and talking about the wine and whatever they were talking about, and I could hear them, but they were in the room next to me. And then with that duck dish, the thin slices of duck on the bottom, I sauteed the two mushrooms, deglazed the pan. I was like, hey guys, give me some red that I can actually cook with. Someone brought in the wine to me. I deglazed the pan with the, actually it was the Archery Summit, and added, I had braised short ribs for our last course because, again, I knew we would be drinking a lot of red wine. So I used a little bit of that braising liquid, deglazed with the red, let the mushrooms sit with that stock and the red wine, and then poured that over the magre. And it was all about the mushrooms and the sauce with a little bit of duck. It was, you know, and everybody was like, oh my God, can we have more of this? it was fun, and it was beautiful with the tasting. So it was, you know, I was really thankful for that course. And then, as I said, then, you know, there was short ribs after that.
But wine did you guys serve with the...
So with the, we had three American wines because one of the guests, you know, is someone that, you know, has a deep cellar. And, you know, thankfully, so it was a treat to have. We had a 1970 BV cab. And man, you know, well, you'll appreciate
the BV
this.
BV George Latour or the straight...
It was straight BV.
Straight bottling.
And then we also had the 1990 Ridge Petit Syrah York Creek. And then we had a 1998 B.R. Cohen Cab Olive Hill. And having those, it was just, you know, we were tasting, I don't recall exactly which wine we were tasting with which each course, but, you know, there were 11 wines open, so there was a lot of tasting of everything. To have the particularly the BV and the Ridge, which are wines that I was drinking, and you were too, when in the early 80s, you know, that was some of my formative time learning about wine. When I did my apprenticeship in a restaurant in Charleston, the cellar in the restaurant was 90% American wine, and so that was when I first started drinking those. So it was really fun to get to taste wine from those, especially the BV from 1970.
Well, the BV, the 68, 69, 70, 74, 76, 78 are all still pretty darn alive, especially the George Latour bottlings.
Okay.
Those are old 100% Cabernet Sauvignon bottlings that they've aged very well.
They were. I mean, everything we had was amazing. I mean, it was super exciting. What do you and the Ridge, 1990. What are your feelings?
It's Petit Syrah, so they live forever.
Okay.
But they can be like a tank. You know, I don't know that it doesn't land in my taste so much because the wines can be really, really chunky.
Okay.
But they do live forever. Like, it's
okay. Yeah,
it's incredible. You can have this stuff back into the 60s, 70s. They never seem to lose color even.
We also had Bassignani, which of course is a great Maryland wine, and it was the Lorenzino Reserve, 1993, which that was super exciting again to get to taste, because I don't think I've ever had any of his wines that are from that time, so, or that old, and that was really fun to taste.
And that was the Bassignani wine that was on the original Charleston wine list.
Wow.
When that restaurant opened. So
that's cool.
His wines, Bert's wines hold up. Bert's wines hold up no problem. The alcohol is a lot lower than the California's, mm-hmm. as you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that, so that it's not going to show the body and the mass, but to be alive and balanced and have some level of detail from a decent year like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 97 is the one that you like, if you're hunting around for older Bassignani's, that was like the blessed vintage.
Very, very, you know, super exciting. And then we did 3 Chateauneufs, which, of course, I was responsible for, and big surprise.
The Chateauneufs were for the Bray Short Ribs?
Yes, exactly. And we had the Reyes 2004, the Vieille-Julien 2000, which actually was a gift that I had given to one of my guests for Christmas, and he brought it. And I thought, wow, that's super cool, especially since my cellar's packed away somewhere. So it was really great to be able to taste the 2000 Vieille-Julien. And then we had Henri Bonneau's Cuvée Marie Barrière, which was 2003. So that,
shows great.
Wow, that was it.
Three shows great.
Love his wines. So thoughts on those three guys? Yeah,
they're all shows great. Brilliant producers. I mean, mm-hmm. you have very different terroir at Vieille-Julien, but 2000 is a warm year, so it evens things out a little bit. Bonneau's three, that was his top bottling in 2003. He didn't make the Cuvée de Célestin. And your
Reyes.
Yeah, the Reyes, the four, that was probably, by style and also by vintage, that's probably the most gentle of the group and was probably the most evolved of the group. I would expect that to have been more spicy aromatically and a little bit more layered and less tannic than either of the other two,
mm-hmm.
and certainly less alcohol than the other two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fun.
So you'd made Bray Short Ribs.
Right, and served it with a pretty rich potato gratin. I knew we would probably be kind of, you know, there would be a good bit of wine open at that point. I knew I had cheese to finish the meal so that anybody, you know, we were tasting, obviously. So, we were spitting. There were too many wines.
Yeah.
So
cheese, but no sweets.
I did. I made, that was where my unseasonal food came in again. I made strawberries and sabayon, and actually I wanted to talk about it because to me it's the easiest, not the strawberry part, but the sabayon part, and we are coming, you know, will be summertime soon, and strawberries are one of the first things we will get. And sabayon is so easy. It's fun to make. It takes a little bit of time, but you don't need any, you know, you don't have to bake anything.
I mean,
You're
making one warm sauce.
Exactly. So. And it's so good. And it's just, I think people, you know, should try it, which is you whisk.
You just need to have your strawberries ready to go.
Right. So that's what I did. I washed my strawberries, cut the tops off and quartered them and had them in the refrigerator. And then all I did was make the sabayon when I needed it, which is in a bowl over a pot with a little bit of water in the bottom. So it's a double boiler on low heat. You have your, when I had my egg yolks cracked, but you don't even have to do that. So I had my egg yolks and I would do 2 per person. I think that's a good quantity and about 2 tablespoons of sugar per person, but it really depends on the fruit and how sweet the fruit is. And I would say probably if you're doing 6 people, I would do about 6 ounces. That's a lot. Let's say 4 ounces of Madeira. And you could use Marsala if you wanted to instead, which is traditional.
I would think you could use most sweet wines that were white sweet wines.
Okay. And there's so many great, you know, different Madeiras and, you know, different, you know, you can talk more about
that. Yeah, I'd love
to
have it with like a Loire Valley sweet wine that had really good acidity from Chenin Blanc, like Côte de Lyon, something like that.
Okay. So then you just whisk the egg yolks, the sugar, and the alcohol over until it gets very aerated, basically, and thick. And you have this warm, gorgeous, you know, rich, lovely sauce that you can put whatever quantity you want. Just spoon it over your strawberries and your bowls and serve it. And that was, it was a nice finish to the meal after the cheese because there is acidity in the fruit, even though the sauce is a little bit rich. It was just kind of nice to clean up your palate after the cheese. And we had Coulée, which is an amazing British piece that's just so butterscotchy and
Kool-Aid's British, Irish?
Irish, pardon me. It is Irish.
I love that stuff.
Yeah, Kool-Aid is amazing, a hard-pressed piece. And
it's like the color of Velveeta or something, or what you think of as American cheddar.
Oh, boy, but it's just kind of, I can't believe you just said that
word. It is
word.
Not that. Kool-Aid is C-O-O-L-E-A.
Gosh,
if anyone wants to look it up.
Cheese. Just absolutely gorgeous. And we had a couple of other French pieces, or a couple of French pieces, and Chev, an American Chev, Midnight Moon, which is... one of my guests doesn't like Chev, so I only had one Chev. I typically would have had a fresher piece of Chev plus the pressed piece like that.
I bet the person that doesn't like Chev is the person that likes the Petite Sirah.
That's correct.
Yeah, I knew it.
So,
living
but,
a hard life.
You know who that guest is. He's great. So, yeah, it was a fun dinner, and I just wanted to hear what you had to say about those wines. It was a lot of fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you still... Going back to my first statement, I think you still have annoyed a lot of people that you didn't bother to invite to dinner out at the farm. So you guys had so much great wine that you were spitting it. So, So on our next segment on Formidable Fun Food and Wine, I'm going to do a little bit of a primer on Middle European wines. We're coming into the spring and the summer. Some remarkable things, some with sweetness, some drier style things, but... That'd excellent things for a lot of what we're going to have a chance to cook in the next couple of months.
Great. Perfect.
All of that and more on Formula Wolf. And, of course, the Chef's Challenge in the last segment on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And so it sounds like a delightful day that you had out there with everybody.
It was great. I really enjoyed cooking in my, you know, new farm kitchen. It was a pleasure. And to look out at the beautiful view, and it's amazing. I feel very fortunate.
Sometimes just having a few people that you get to cook for, it's really therapeutic.
It really was. Well, and it was five of us.
When you have to cook for... Well, one of the first times we had an event for, you know, it's a flow party of 450 people, and I'm trying to do a million small plates with one of the chefs we work with years ago.
You mean at your house?
No.
Oh. I'm like, wait, what? 450 people? I was like,
I think
what?
I've had 98. I think I've served 90 people
about?
At my house for.
Well, yeah, but we were talking about cooking at home,
thing.
So you threw me on that one.
Yeah,
okay.
No, I was just thinking about the opposite situation, which is that, you know, you're having to do it professionally and you have to have it completely organized, and you've
got totally different
preparation going on for 4 days that lead up to the culmination of the event itself, and it's just that's
working in a professional kitchen and a home kitchen.
That's an engineering job as much as it is.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, for 450.
Is actually cooking, you know.
That's a crazy amount of people. Mm-hmm. No, this was a lot of fun.
Anyway, what's been on my brain has been a lot of Middle European wines, which...
It's not always something we talk about, so...
No, and I think that the people don't... Their worries or their prejudices about those wines or... There are a certain number of people who, if they walk into a wine shop, they think, oh, Riesling, where do I find Riesling? It's like it's going to be inexpensive and it's going to be tasty. And what else should they, you know? I mean, that the alcohol's not too high. Well, they're immediately thinking of German Riesling.
Okay.
And there are entry-level wines that are that way. But there are wines that, there are things to know about those wines. But it's not just when I say Middle European wines. It's not just the German wines that, you know, when you think of that client that has that sort of popular thing in their mind, there's wines from Alsace that have great food flexibility and that are often the best purchase in white wine in France. And almost always, it's funny, when people ask for advice going to France and looking at wine lists and like, well, I don't want to get clobbered.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just find a good Pinot Blanc from Alsace.
Okay.
chances are it's going to be pretty dry, maybe not completely bone dry. It's going to work for a lot of different food. It's not going to be a big piece of money. And the average grower, I mean, like you throw a, you know, blindfolded, throwing a, you know, a dart at a board with names of growers and all that, they're pretty darn conscientious, so.
Great.
You know, quality for the price, just randomly, you're going to do a little better there than a lot of other places.
It's also such a beautiful region. What a great place to visit. That would be a good, would that be a good summertime visit? Or is it really hot there? Well, I guess some people like it really
no,
hot.
No, it's pretty spectacular in the summer. Because the nights are a little bit cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons the acidities are good in the wines. So I thought it'd be helpful for people going into a season when you may want to have white wines that do have a little, besides the rosé that everyone wants to drink right at this moment. You know, the blooms are on the trees and you want pink wine. And in midsummer when the tomatoes come, it's great to have, you know, the pink wines from Provence again. But along the way, there's a lot of things from Middle Europe that can be really, really functional. As much as people love sushi, as much as people love raw fish, as much as people love spicy cooking and Asian ethnic cooking, a lot of those dishes, or if you want to have wine with those dishes, much more successful with the Middle European wines. The other sort of big place that I think about when I think about Middle Europe is, of course, Austria. And when you think Austria, you immediately think of the big area near Vienna, the Wachau and the Wagram for whites, the famous Riesling in a very different style from Germany, very bone-dry style, and the Grüneveltliner, which is a different thing again, and brighter and snappier and almost spicier than Riesling is. And then you think of the area south, the old Habsburg Empire along the Dolomites. When you get into the southern Tyrol, which is across the Italian border, and the Alto Adige.
Great region.
Another beautiful region.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of really brilliant whites.
Okay.
Bone dry again.
Fresh.
Very fresh.
Cold nights, right?
Some things that are light, some things,
cold
well,
nights.
You're in the mountains,
yeah,
so.
Yeah, cool nights.
Yeah, nights are cool again.
Lots
so.
Of air.
Yeah, but great sunshine. That's the other thing about the continental climate and in a lot of Middle Europe is you have that great sunshine for a short period of time, and you have a lot of light for a short period of time.
That's
so you get hang time for these grapes.
Got it.
So
why do they trellis? What's the reason for trellising?
First and foremost, to get things off the ground so there's not as much mold.
Okay, all right.
And think about it. I mean, that's...
So, yeah, well...
When you're drying clothes, you don't throw them on the ground. They'll smell bad mostly.
Right. That's true. I don't do that.
I mean, that's just a basic, it's a basic like functional, like if you want less mold, good air circulation between the vines is really, really important. When you have cool nights or if you do have little bits of high humidity and cool nights, you'll tend to accumulate in the clusters themselves. You think about it, right? In the grape clusters, you will accumulate little bits of moisture, and then mold will spring up naturally in some of those places.
Okay.
That'll destroy the flavors of...
Sure.
You know, that'll destroy the flavors of almost all of the grapes that are being grown. In Alsace, things to know, Riesling remains the big, important grape through most of Middle Europe. In Alsace, that's still the most important white grape for aging. In Alsace, by the way, they do make some red. It's Pinot Noir. It is not often the most attractive thing. There are very brave people that make great efforts to make Pinot Noir that's worthwhile in Alsace. That is not often the result that occurs.
Well, that's not what we think of when we think of the region.
No.
There's a reason, apparently.
Yeah, there is a reason. But Riesling is the most important. The other two most important grapes for ageability are both sweeter in general than the production style. Besides Riesling, the most important, two other most important grapes for ageability and complexity, you typically think of are Pinot Gris,
mm-hmm.
which is the same thing in Italian they'll call Pinot Grigio.
Okay.
Grown in Alsace, it tends to be, can be as rich as Chardonnay. It's the same family, it's a Pinot family. There are 48 grapes in the Pinot family. Mm-hmm. Pinot Noir is one, Pinot Grigio is one, Pinot Meunier, and so on and so on and so on. But that tends to be a bit sweeter than Riesling and denser, thicker, as you would expect. Whereas Riesling is always bright, light on its feet. And very, very long and a real pure vector for communicating the soil and the conditions. That's Riesling's special talent, translating a location. And then Gewürztraminer is the third. And Gewürztraminer is not a grape from Alsace at all, but it's become popular there. And Gewürztraminer tends to be, when it does bloom correctly and ripen correctly, tends to be the richest of these three and the most exotic as well. And a lot of people, Lord knows a lot of wine writers will say people have a love or hate relationship with Gewürztraminer. It's just super aromatic and it can be very rose petally and and lychee. And you have to be in the mood for that much personality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certain grapes are kind of like people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Riesling has a very, it's that person with a great wit and a very sharp tone. And you may love it all the time, maybe not with a hangover or something, but Pinot Gris is everybody's friend.
Okay.
You know, that's Gewürztraminer is a little loud and brassy.
Okay, got
and
it.
And is maybe not always the person you're choosing to have an in-depth conversation with if you're in a quiet mood.
Got it.
But those are the three most important in Alsace. Pinot Blanc, usually it just means white Pinot. Mm-hmm. So you'll see Pinot Blanc on labels. And Pinot Blanc means usually either Pinot Vrai, true Pinot, whatever in the world that's supposed to mean. It's one particular cultivar. And then the other is Pinot Auxerrois, which is somewhat smokier in flavor. Pinot Vrai is much more sort of like apple skin, if that makes sense. And most often, honestly, those two are blended. And any of the leftover bits of Pinot something, Pinot Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, Pinot Bio, which literally means buttery Pinot. That's even more opulent than the Pinot Gris.
Sounds like my kind of Pinot.
It's not the most complex.
Okay.
It's not the most complex.
I didn't realize there were 48 different types of.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Pinot. Okay.
I took a long walk one time with Marcel Dice in a vineyard outside of Bergheim, where they had co-planted all of these different grapes, and in one stretch, there were all 48 Pinot grapes planted on one sort of ridge.
That's pretty amazing.
And to go through and looking at the leaf types to tell them apart.
Gosh.
Because they were just little, you know, buds
mm-hmm.
at that moment in time. But he, you know, from long, long practice in his life.
Yeah, he's an amazing winemaker.
He's a bit of a wizard, that Marcel Dice.
Mm-hmm.
But some other things to know in Alsace, and Dice is a great grower. If you want Alsace wine that's drier, Trimbach is a large production, excellent quality grower.
Trimbach. Okay.
Gassmann. A lot of these names are German names. Gassmann is a great grower. Albert Boxler. The matriarchy that is Weinbach.
Right.
Are great growers. Not always the great purchase in Weinbach. They can be pretty expensive.
Okay.
But... And there are Grand Cru sites that have particular names that you see, Mambourg or Clos Saint-Yun, that sort of thing. They tend to drive up prices a bit. But an awful lot of people just make a little easier for us varietally labeled wines. So that's the sort of the basics on Alsace and things to look for. It is not hard to find a very tasty bottle of Alsace wine that is almost bone dry if you want it to be.
Okay.
Or is a bit sweet in a retail store for under $20.
That's great.
It is not that hard to do.
That's good.
And sometimes for just a couple more, you can have something really special. Now, German wine. Now, are you scared German wine is going to be sweet?
No. Yes. No? Maybe yes. A little bit. Yes.
See, that is the public's response on German wine. Okay.
I'm the public.
It's unless it says it's trocken, which means dry.
Okay.
It's not going to be dry.
Okay.
Okay.
Trocken. Like what goes before the word trocken?
Trocken?
I thought it was the end of a word. Got it. Okay.
No. Okay. So that the designations of sweetness or ripeness levels, that's different from this. The sweetness and ripeness levels, I love German terminology. No one else likes it so much. Okay. The designations are called Qualitätswein mit Prädikat.
And
those wines, the least sweet of those is called Cabinet.
Okay.
Okay. And you can expect that to be maybe 11% alcohol and have some sweetness to it and not be that rich. The Spätlese, which is a very popular level, is a bit sweeter and a bit richer and a bit less alcohol. less alcohol translates into more sugar. It's really not a complicated thing. The next level up is Auslese, which means you're getting into something that is either for very rich cooking or beginning of dessert or cheese or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Auslese is also age super duper well.
Okay.
And they seem to lose some sucrosity as they age and gain more and more of the mineral flavors that Rieslings are so famous for.
So like how old can they be? What are we talking about?
In a great year,
mm-hmm.
like the 76s are drinking great.
That's awesome. Okay.
Is
that something people can find, do you think?
No.
Okay. All right.
No, you have to have some ridiculous collector friend who
okay.
put these things away and let them lecture you how much smarter they are than you are, because they put them away and it cost them $4 and all this kind of stuff.
Okay.
And then flat-out dessert wines are Trockenbeeren Auslese. And the thing that people most often get confused about ice wine literally means that the grapes are frozen on the vine and then picked. What happens is all the water creates the ice around the grape. So what's inside essentially is like dried.
Okay.
So it's kind of
like...
It's a different version of nature making wine like Amarone, but from white grapes in a cold place instead of a warm, dry place.
Does bottle shape have anything to do with all of this?
They're all tall, skinny bottles.
Okay. All right.
But,
so
I mean, in Alsace, they're tall, skinny bottles. In Germany,
dry
they're tall, skinny. No, they don't designate
okay.
one way or the other.
All right.
And when you get to the Austrian wines, they're tall, skinny bottles. And they're almost all bone dry.
Is there a reason for the tall, skinny bottle? Or
in
is
the Alto Adige. Yeah. Almost all tall, skinny.
That's
although
right.
you have a big Italian influence, so there's a certain randomness to
okay, yeah,
to some of the varietals. Like a grape varietal, like Sauvignon, grows a decent amount in the Alto Adige, Sauvignon Blanc, and they'll tend to, some growers or cooperatives will tend to put them in Bordeaux style bottles, which you would think of as being appropriate for that kind of grape, since it's a Bordeaux grape originally.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The other thing that while there's not a reason for the bottles being tall and skinny, other than it's traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sure pack an awful lot of those things into a case. It's actually very efficient, not a shock with the culture we're talking about. The labels, they can be hard to read for us because we're used to reading like a varietal. It's like Smith family Pinot Noir or something, right? There you might have, like a lot of European wines, it's identified by place. So Peaceport is a town in the middle of Mosel.
Hmm.
Peace Porter would be a wine coming from Peaceport.
Okay.
Goldtropfen is the gold cap. It refers to the site. Okay. Or Velener, the town of Velen. Sonnenur, the sundial. There's a vineyard that's called the Sundial Vineyard that has a particular exposure that's a high quality exposure. You know, when you see Velener, Sonnenur, Spätlese, it tells you the sweetness level. And exactly where it's coming from,
the vineyard
all
site.
In one shot.
Okay. And where's the winemaker's name? Is it like little at the bottom?
It'll usually be at the bottom there. Maybe Dr. Tanish or something
okay.
like that.
Okay. All right. So what's typically the biggest thing that you see? Or is it not always that way?
No. You see an awful lot of, there's a certain like romance with Baroque labels and that sort of thing for the most part. When you see that, you'll see more modern labels with some of the Austrians. They're trying to be, tricky about that stuff. And it will say Riesling somewhere on the bottle, but because it's from these places, it's from the Mosel or the Rhine, the Rheinhessen, the Nahe, the Saar, the Pfalz, that any of those areas, it's going to be Riesling.
Okay.
That's what once in a great while you'll see another grape like Chiruba, and it'll say that very clearly, that it's that. And usually they'll use those grapes for dessert wines purely. So the difference in the tall, skinny bottles in Austria and what's on the label, we'll say like most of the great whites are grown along the Danube in villages like Spitz or Dürnstein. And those villages have a very small number of growers. They're very small places. And they grow principally two grapes. And the better sites around them have this sort of strange... The better bottlings are called Smaragd, and the younger vine bottlings and the poorer sites are called Federspiel. And they're all identified by the vineyard sites but usually not the town. That's the strange thing, because the grower only does stuff from the town that they're in for the most part. So if that makes any sense.
Sure.
So the great growers like Knoll or Hirtberger, Pichler, it's you already know there's a certain understanding of that. They're from Spitz. This is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay.
Is this making any sense?
It does.
So that's the dry stuff from Austria. That's the Riesling and the Grüneveltliner that are there. And they will age very well from good growers. And by very well, I mean 10, 15, 20 years. And peaking a lot of times, 8 to 12 years. Okay. Which is, and really remarkable stuff. And dry and clean. And your last zone is the Alto Adige on the Italian side. And that's a lot of the same grapes. And a few more thrown into the soup, too. that you think of... that don't do as well in Germany, like Müller-Thurgau and Silvaner, but they're always identified by grape names. So you've all of a sudden gotten easier. It's like Turlano, the cooperative name, and the Silvaner. Or once in a while you get a fantasy name, because we are across the Italian border, right? So there's a bottling, Elena Valk has a bottling called We're Dreams, which is a blend of a bunch of different grapes.
I don't know, but all I can think about is sauerkraut right now for some reason.
Yeah, well, it's...
And I know that's not fair to the food.
No, it's not fair to the food.
So many wonderful things, yeah. But...
In the Alto Adige, you think of canoodle, you know?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
A lot of the German wines would do great with Thai food.
Okay.
You know, that those Grüneveltliners are fantastic with sushi, especially spicy sushi.
Okay.
So, just a couple of ideas. Anyway, we need to move on into our third segment. When we come back from break, it's going to be Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. And a chef's challenge, and we have a nice twist for Chef Sandy Wolf on WYPR. Welcome back to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Chef Cindy Wolf, your mission, if you choose to accept it, in this chef's challenge, besides reading my stupid handwriting,
is to
deal with that.
It's all tapa. Tapa.
You're making all these ingredients into tapas.
Okay.
Or hors d'oeuvres. It's for an hors d'oeuvre party.
All right. Half a pound of head-on shrimp, fennel bulb.
Or one, a tapas fiesta.
One duck leg, Calabrian chilies, green olives. Castelvetrano, Dale baguette, 2 cups chickpea soup, spicy, which is kind of interesting that I have something that's already made, baby artichokes, pecorino, 30-year-old balsamico, eggs, fresh oregano, sun-dried tomatoes, wow, which I haven't worked with in a long time, that like immediately says 1985 to me, extra virgin olive oil, 1 chicken, is this breast? 2 dozen clams, chorizo. Okay, good stuff.
It's one of those, like, what I was thinking is, what's the situation? You have people coming. You picked up some things. You have some things in the fridge.
Right.
You got some things that are left.
Okay.
Okay. You got, like, 10 people coming. Make a party.
All right. So the chicken...
By the way, you got 4 minutes to do it.
I'm definitely putting the sun-dried tomatoes with the chicken breast. So I'll grill the chicken breasts and slice them very thin and just have them laid out on... tray with, I'll take some of the sun-dried tomatoes and the fresh oregano and the pecorino, actually, and make a little relish. So with the sun-dried tomato, if they're nice and moist still, then you can chop them. If you have to reconstitute them, I would probably...
I think like tomatoes that you put up from last year.
Yeah, okay.
That
so
you roasted
nice.
Gently,
so
put up in oil.
Beautiful. And... Okay. So yeah, I can hand chop those and add a little bit of that pecorino, which I would... probably great sort of thicker and add and a little bit of extra virgin olive oil over the chicken breast. And of course, I probably would have put a little bit of that fresh oregano on it before I grilled it, kosher salt, black pepper, and a little bit of corn oil to grill. And actually, just for fun, I think I would put a tiny bit of balsamico in there to marinate the chicken breast, which will give it a little bit of nice caramelization on the grill because of the sugar content of the balsamico, but just a tiny bit. And so you have a tray of that. And then I love baby artichokes, so I'm going to slice them thin and really thin and serve them raw with a nice amount of lemon juice. And I'm going to steam open the clams with a little bit of some ingredients that aren't listed here, like garlic, shallots, white wine, and steam open the clams and have them
it's
laid out.
It's reasonable to think that you have onion product in your
right
in your pantry and a bottle of white wine.
Right. And I love the fact that there's a little chorizo here. So I would probably have a little bit of thinly sliced chorizo out just to enjoy on its own because I can't help myself because I love chorizo so much. But I think a little julienne of very fine julienne or matchstick of the chorizo over the warm or hot, excuse me, clams laid out over the raw artichoke would be really pretty. And you're going to have to give that artichoke, like I said, a little lemon, a little olive oil, a good extra virgin olive oil. And the Calabrian chilies would be good too. So a little bit of all that. And what I'm left with here is, well, the chickpea soup and the fact that it's spicy, I would just serve that in little espresso cups, make that hot, pass it around, and I would put a little bit of some oil, again, that probably had a tiny bit of the Calabrian chili in it on top, just to really kind of make it this moment of taste that's spicier and different than the soup. Day-old baguette means I can do some bruschetta, so thinly slice the baguette. And in this case, because it's tapas, I'm going to actually rub it with a little, brush it with a little bit of extra virgin and grill them rather than what I like to do for cheese, which is brush them with butter and put them in the oven. So grill them, chop up the beautiful olives, and that duck leg, I would have confit. And I would just pick the meat and have these wonderful, small, just fabulous pieces of duck leg on the bruschetta and garnish with a little bit of, again, raw, finely shaved fennel bulb. I like having that. And I actually have never put duck and fennel together, but I think that would be very pretty. And you have the head-on shrimp that I haven't used. So I'm going to, you have eggs on here that I haven't used. What else do I have? That's it. So
you can eat two of the eggs for lunch and not worry about it.
The head-on shrimp, I'm going to cook on the plancha. So I have a nice double-handled, it's actually Teflon-coated, which that's the only piece of equipment I have in my kitchen
like
that has Teflon.
Big heavy griddle top.
Yeah, griddle top, and just pop that on, get it nice and hot, throw some kosher salt on, a little inexpensive extra virgin, and just pop those shrimp on there, shell on, head on, and let people peel them. And you can have a little bit of, again, a little bit of the Calabrian chili oil on the table, a little lemon on the table, and then I've used all the ingredients. So there.
All right, let's see. Really? Really?
What? Is that good or bad?
No. It's just almost funny. You have such a love affair with sweetbreads. You mention it in every program. When you don't mention it, you put it on my chef's challenge. So sweetbreads. I like sweetbreads also.
Sheesh.
Wagyu boneless beef short rib. English peas, local asparagus, lemon verbena, eggs, cream, flour, sugar. Morel mushrooms, beef stock, octopus, sportelletti, so better get olive oil from Umbria, soft shell crab, butter, lemon, lime, blood orange, rocket, onion, shallots, garlic, spring onions, habanero pepper, poblano pepper. Okay. Tony, what will you serve with your dishes? I gotta make something first. Oh, what I really want. I really want the morels with the asparagus and the peas as a first course. And what I honestly, really gently cooked, slowly, patiently cooked, like nice big pieces of sweetbread once it's been purged and poached. You know, but like take it to like rare, medium rare so you can cook it gently in clarified butter and then serve it with a big garnish of a salad, like a warm salad of the asparagus, the peas, the morel mushrooms. That would be okay.
That would be okay. I'd like to have that immediately.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't put ingredients on my list for you that I don't like.
Yeah, no, doing that properly, I think you need, like, no sauce. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the tiniest little drop of brown butter or something, but I don't think so. What else would we do? The soft shell crab. Soft shell crab and the octopus would be an interesting course to follow that. Soft shell crab, like fried with a rocket salad with poblanos and a little habanero and some of the spring onions. That would be pretty great. Sweet garlic vinaigrette for that with a lot of the citrus. I would like that. I still have a short rib to deal with. I guess that's got to be main course, huh? And you got beef stock. Well, I've got octopus to deal with. I should have dealt with the octopus as maybe an hors d'oeuvre or a snack, where it's, you know, you braise it, you cool it, and then you grill it to get it all crispy on the outside. Mm-hmm. Slice it very, very thin, and if you've got, that's great with bruschetta.
Yeah, that would be fun.
You can make a little salad with some of the other onion products if you have really, if they're sweet onions or the shallot, and if you have a little smoked paprika maybe in your spice cabinet, mm-hmm. that would be great. You gave me cream. I don't want that with that. Sorry, thinking out loud. what else have I got to fool around with? Eggs. I'll eat two eggs for lunch. The short rib, I'm going to braise in the beef stock. I'm going to dig a bottle of red wine out of the cellar that has really good color and really good acid, and add that to braising, get that very nice and tight, and then I have nothing to serve with the beef. I guess I could have reserved the peas. That seems kind of, beef and peas seems a little English. I don't think I can do that, as much respect as I have for the English. I'm out of garnishes with beef. You thought you gave me so many ingredients. Lemon verbena is not going to cut it for the beef.
No.
No, it's not. Lemon verbena.
Well, so if you had whatever you wanted, what would you put with the beef?
Well, if I could braise it in a lot of onion product as well as the red wine and the beef stock, mm-hmm. Then I would probably put farro on the plate with a lot of green parsley to have a little freshness to it and a little bite to the starch that goes with that. So I think that's where I am.
Sounds good.
Anyway, what I'll serve with it? A giant, like, 4-liter bottle of 20-year-old Chianti Classico from Cru Sorbo. Anyway, that's all we have time for on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
If you want to download this program or any other podcasts, look up the Foreman & Wolf page on the WYPR site. And if you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Instagram at Chef Wolf and on Twitter at Chef Cindy Wolf.
You can reach us with questions or comments at foremanwolf@wypr.org. Thanks so much for listening.
Have a great Sunday.